Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Where do we start this morning? Well, let's start with the President of the United States continuing his national super spreader tour. Last night, he was in Iowa, and he had some complaints.
Get nominated for 3 Nobel Peace Prizes, different subjects. And I told the story the other night. I was in Florida, where Pennsylvania. I told our First Lady, darling, we're going to have the greatest publicity I've ever had tonight. I got nominated for the Nobel Prize. Do you know what that is, darling? Let's go home. So I leave for the first time in a long time early. I get home. I turn on the television. They talked about your floods in Iowa. They talked about how's Iowa doing the crops? How's this happening? How are they doing in Florida? How the 3-4 stories, one after another. Where's my Nobel Peace Prize? They don't talk about it. I said, you know, darling, this news is a little tough. It's a little tough to crack. When Obama got his Nobel Prize, it was so early, he didn't even do anything. He still doesn't know what he got it for. They said, why did you get it? He said, I have no idea. And it was the biggest story. It was all over the place. With me, I got 3, and they got 3 nominations. Nobody talks about it.
He'll talk about it. He'll talk about it endlessly. So joining me on the podcast today, Kim Whaley, law professor, constitutional expert, former U.S. attorney, author of the book, What You Need to Know About Voting and Why. Kim, where do we start with the psychological projection there? The president giving one of the variations of his, it's all about me, 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 me speech.
Right. And he's such a victim. It's always that he is the underdog. He is just kicked around. The bad guys are always at his throat, whereas, of course, he has more power than virtually anyone else on the planet. So, you know, this isn't new. But it is kind of interesting that he reportedly complained that he's only up 6 points and he's a little bit concerned. I mean, that sort of show of weakness at a rally or concern is also, I think, pretty that is new for someone like Donald Trump.
Well, that's an interesting question, whether he knows he's losing. It's an interesting question, maybe irrelevant what he knows, whether or not he lives in this alternative reality bubble. But he's, you know, as I said in my newsletter this morning, he's certainly not acting like a winner. He's kind of acting like somebody whose luck has run out. But I just love the riff on the Nobel Peace Prize and how everybody is so unfair to him, and how he is constantly comparing himself to Barack Obama. I mean, I don't know whether he was actually nominated 3 times or not. He probably made that up, like a lot of the other stuff. But he's talking to people in Iowa complaining that he turns on the television and they were spending time on the natural disaster that took place in their state. Like, and they didn't get to me. It was, you know, for chapter 999, his lack of empathy or compassion is extraordinary. Okay, so Kim, I wanted to talk to you about a number of things. Obviously, the Amy Coney Barrett hearings are wrapping up today. That confirmation is on track. I want to get to that. But I also wanted to get to something that I started my newsletter off today with, which is the good news. And this is something that you have been tracking closely. This story of the early voting is really kind of extraordinary. It is a compelling story. Just read this AP account out of Savannah, Georgia. They came by the thousands to vote early. Descendants of slaves, children of the civil rights era, another Georgian standing in line for hours when all of them could have been somewhere else. And they're talking about the voting process. Washington Post talking about the fact that the 3 weeks to go before November 3rd, roughly 15 million Americans have already voted in the fall election. So talk to me a little bit about what we are seeing happen, because there have been so many anxieties about the mail-in balloting. The Trump folks have been investing a tremendous amount of effort in trying to discredit early voting. And yet you are seeing at least what feels like it's a tsunami at the moment.
Yeah, it's really heartwarming or chilling or a combination. And I say that because historically, only approximately 50% of eligible voters vote in the United States. And the Knight Foundation did a study in January before the coronavirus saying the number one reason Americans don't vote is they think their vote doesn't matter. And then we saw COVID, we saw a registration dive because, you know, DMVs and other places to register weren't open. And then we see the president, the attorney general, assaulting mail-in voting, assaulting drop boxes. We see across the country lawsuits from the right, frankly, trying to make it harder to vote in a pandemic. We see threats of, you know, bullying at the polls. We'll probably see that. Claims that this is going to be contested and should go to the Supreme Court. Claims that maybe Republican legislatures are just going to hand their electoral college votes to Trump right before the electors are supposed to meet in December. And I drew the conclusion a few weeks ago, Charlie, that the only way to sort of save democracy through this tsunami of assaults on it is by, to sort of belabor the term, a tsunami of voting. I mean, this is the only way. People ask me all the time. It has to be an avalanche to the point where it just becomes silly to claim mail-in voting is fraudulent. And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing this early. It's just a really amazing thing that the better angels of American democracy, or what brought us together as a nation, are coming back to the fore. I just hope, I don't want to jinx it, but it's extraordinary because, as you and I've talked about, it's not Trump or Biden on the ballot. It is American democracy itself. So 4 more years of Mr. Trump, it's done. The experiment's over, and I think people are seeing that. At least it looks like they're seeing that with these numbers.
Well, you know, I've been saying things like, you know, it's 21 days to go until Election Day, 20 days to go until Election Day. Today's 19 days to go until Election Day, which is actually not true because today is Election Day. It's going on right now. November 3rd is just the deadline for the ongoing election. And this is part of this mental adjustment that we're having here. So a couple of things. The polls would indicate a dramatic split. I mean, just mind-blowing. Split between the people who are voting early / by mail versus the people who are planning on voting on Election Day. Overwhelmingly, the early vote is going to Biden. Overwhelmingly, it looks like the Election Day vote is going to Trump. What are the consequences of that?
Well, you know, I think you're right. And maybe I'm guilty of the same thing. The focus on the third is probably misplaced, in part because we will not know on the third. You know, certain swing states do not even count any of their ballots. So we might be hearing these ballots coming in, but state by state, it really depends. Some states, they can't count a single ballot until they're all cast. And for mail-in ballots, that means opening them, matching signatures, doing that auditing process, unfolding them, smoothing them out, and feeding them through machines. If things aren't, some states, if it's not, if the voter didn't sign the ballot properly, they get an opportunity to fix it. You have to contact the voter. I mean, this is a complicated, long-standing, you know, drawn-out process. So I think what this suggests is a couple things. One is that it might have not just hurt Trump, but maybe even, you know, other Republicans on the ballot to have this false claim that mail-in balloting is unsafe and rife with fraud, because it just, the numbers might be there, not be there for the Republican Party in the way they are for the Democrats in a pandemic, because, you know, elderly people, for example, it's harder to get around AB. They're more likely to get sick. So that they, you know, maybe they'll stay home. We just don't know. The second thing, though, is, again, Trump, I think it's well predicted or anticipated on the third, he's going to use he's hoping probably for more, you know, in-person balloting in favor of him. He's going to declare, oh, the election is mine. All these mail-in ballots are fake. But the fact that these numbers are like this now, I just don't think that sort of is not going to work. He almost sort of showed his hand too early. I think Americans know that this claim that mail-in voting is rife with fraud. People have heard enough that that's wrong. And the military votes by mail. They've been doing it since the 80s, thanks to Ronald Reagan, right? And secondly, just with this massive numbers, what do you see? All of those are going to be discounted? I just don't think it's there. I always think of like Game of Thrones and some huge battle, you know, on some planes, right? If you just have lots and lots of people on the other side, it's really hard to claim that you won. They're just so many on the other direction. So
you do feel that there was a backlash that by planting all the doubts about the mail-in balloting and by having all the controversy about the possibility of suppression, this seems to have aroused this huge counter movement that we're seeing right now, the people standing in line for 11 hours. Okay, now speaking of which, when you see those lines in Georgia, those long lines. I mean, the positive aspect is, look, people are really committed. They are turning out early. They are showing, much, much more motivation than you might have suspected, or certainly a rather dramatic amount. On the other hand, there are people who look at those lines and say, this is what voter suppression looks like. There's no way that people should have to wait, hours and hours and hours to vote. So where do you come down on all of this?
Yeah, I mean, Senator Cory Booker really did a tremendously moving statement yesterday in Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation hearings, where he talks about sort of the disparities for people of color and white people, and how, he asked her, have you ever waited even an hour to vote? And she said, no. Voter suppression is real, and it goes as far back as the founding of this republic, which was founded on the backs of slavery, human slavery. And that disparity lives in our culture, and it certainly lives in at the ballot box. And unfortunately, a conservative leaning court struck down a critical part of the Voting Rights Act in 2013, which, don't get me going on the notion that conservatives aren't going to respect acts of Congress. That seems exactly what Coney Barrett, you'd think, would not do, is that kind of judicial activism by striking down bipartisan legislation that reflects the will of the people. But as a result, it's that basically election officials can say, we're going to put resources here versus there. And if they can justify it as somehow related to election management, the fact that it has this disparate impact is very, very hard to turn around in the courts, which is why Congress passed the Voting Rights Act. The silver lining, Charlie, is I think people are paying attention to voting now. People are learning a lot about the right to vote, about the Constitution, about how absolutely vital going to the polls is if you want to hold on to your ability to control your own government, regardless of political party. And again, I mean, I'm hopeful if we make it through to January 20th and go back to an actual accountable government with someone without a serious personality disorder in the White House, that we'll have more civic participation. That's my dream anyway.
Okay, so I have one more question about, possible downsides to all of this, with the mail-in voting in particular being so heavily skewed toward the Democrats. What percent of those ballots are going to be considered spoiled? And of course, a lot of focus on Pennsylvania, where the Supreme Court ruled that if you filled out the ballot, you did everything right, but you didn't put it in this secrecy sleeve, they could throw out your vote. They could disenfranchise you if you came in with a naked ballot. But there have been reports, at least during the primaries, of rather alarmingly large numbers of votes that were thrown out because of technical problems, signatures, et cetera. So how worried are you about that as a factor, particularly because the impact will be quite disparate, depending on, if you have 50,000 votes thrown out in Pennsylvania, those are likely to be skew heavily toward Joe Biden, not Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, 550,000 mail-in ballots were thrown out over the summer during the primaries. I mean, that's a huge number. 550,000. And there are a couple of reasons. One was for delays in the post office. So I do also think, the cute maneuver to try to co-opt the post office and kneecap it, basically, that seems to have failed. We're not seeing the post office become sort of an arm of the Trump administration or the Trump campaign to sort of force his way into four more years. And I think people have gotten sort of aware of the notion they have to mail them early or drop them off. So I think hopefully the Postal Service basis for throwing out ballots will go away. But, the issue when people talk about fraud, it's really administration. And these are complicated systems. I mean, I really would love to see a federal ballot. We all do it the same way, but states are doing it differently. And we are going to see disenfranchisement by virtue of just filling out the ballot wrong. I mean, unfortunately, you're not in the polling site where you've got a poll worker who's going to sort of clarify any questions you might have or double check what you have is accurate. If you do it early and you're in a state that is required by law to alert you, then you can fix it. But not every state can do that. So, I've been getting on every airwave possible as many times as I can to send the message. You have to meticulously read your mail-in ballot and get it in early. But you have to literally read every line, turn it over, make sure it's in the right you know, right envelope and that the envelope signed. We will see, Charlie, we will see a lot of people cut out of the polls. That's why the tsunami metaphor is so important. It has to be so overwhelming, an avalanche, that the inevitable people that fall through the cracks don't turn the election. If it's a close election in a purple state, that's where we get into huge issues, not just in terms of who's president, but in terms of whether American democracy will survive at all.
You know, I did vote early here in Wisconsin. And look, I've done this before, but I was obsessed this year with getting it right. I mean, it was like I did exactly what you said. It was looking at it again, looking at it a third time, making sure, showing it to my wife, going back and forth, all of this. And so I think maybe a lot of the anxieties broke early enough that people did develop this plan.
Right.
And therefore, it is playing out. OK, so I want to talk about the state of the race here. Donald Trump is, he's been really, really lucky until now in many ways. I know you can, we can parse that out, in terms of the economy and stuff. But, things are not breaking his way right now. I mean, you have these job numbers that came out today, which show that, 7 months into this crisis, we're still having nearly 900,000 Americans filing for unemployment comp. Not good. He's been declaring the fight over the coronavirus won. Yesterday, there were nearly 60,000 new cases in one day, which is disastrous. We are headed for a new peak. We're still seeing 1,000 people dying a day. And so less than 3 weeks before the election day, he's pleading for the suburban women to like him. He's mocking senior citizens. He's insulting Navy SEALs. And he's really relying on this voter suppression. And he's really been kind of hoping for this kind of October surprise. And before we get to the other one, he's clearly very disappointed that Bill Barr did not deliver it to him. He really has been kind of counting on, wasn't he?
Right. I mean, so then we see this nonsense in the New York Post about computers. I could be wrong, but some of the allure of Donald Trump, even before he became president, was this sense that he's tough, that he's no nonsense. I mean, people that I know that still support him. Well, I just like that he speaks his mind and he doesn't let anyone push him around and he says it like it is. I think frankly, the virus and how he's handled his own illness, with the sort of strong arming, pathetic, pancake makeup scene on the balcony. I think he just looks weak.
What happened with the Department of Justice? I want to go for the surprise because he in his mind, he's still thinking of, the James Comey, right, Hillary email type moment. He was hoping for the Durham investigation. He was hoping for the unmasking investigation, and 1-2 punch for him. Bill Barr's Department of Justice did not deliver him what he so desperately wanted. So what happened here? What's the story, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, meanwhile, we haven't heard from Bill Barr, so you kind of wonder what's going on with him. But anyway, he's just been in hiding. I think, Mr. Durham is a career prosecutor. And so they look at the evidence, they look at the facts, and they haven't been able to find anything. Listen, as you know, I worked in the Whitewater investigation under Ken Starr, and people to this day say, oh, Hillary's a criminal. And I'll tell you, I was there. If the evidence was there to prosecute her, they would have done it. It's just the courts are still kind of old fashioned. You're bound by evidence. This is why Trump campaign is losing on these voting challenges, because there literally is no meaningful evidence of voter fraud. And likewise, I think what happened was Bill Barr can't manufacture something out of thin air. And Durham is just saying, listen, I can't give it to you. And so, Trump could replace Bill Barr, but that new person's not going to go to Durham and have Durham come up with something that just doesn't exist. And so I think it represents a misunderstanding on Trump's part of how the law really works, which is based, as from common law, from the Magna Carta, on a creation of a factual scenario that is supported by actual evidence, testimony, documents. It's real. It can't just be a tweet. It can't be a fiction. And also, Mr. Durham is he grew up in the Justice Department, and I was in the Justice Department, other parts of the government. These people take their job seriously. They take their oath of office seriously. This deep state notion that people that answer to Trump all of a sudden are against Trump just doesn't borne out with these public servants who could be in the private sector making $1 million a year in a fancy law firm, but instead they decide to act in the public interest. And I think that's still what we're seeing.
Okay. So again, on the unmasking, you had the U.S. Attorney John Bash, who left the department last week and nobody knows quite why. He he ended that review without any criminal charges or any public report. Again, as you point out, we have not heard from Bill Barr. President Trump is, by the way, clearly unhappy with Barr. So the question is whether Barr, you know, what I guess I'm trying to get some sense of what the dynamic here was. Was it that you had these career officials who just told Barr, I don't care what you want, I'm just not doing it? Did Bill Barr let the president down because otherwise he faced a full-scale revolt from the Department of Justice?
Well,
because I guess I'm not willing to think that Bill Barr suddenly woke up and said, you know, I really should, you know, show my independence from the president and uphold the rule of law. It almost feels like he pressed the buttons and everybody said, we're not playing anymore.
Yeah, I mean, that's possible. But what I'm trying to say is that, you know, at the end of the day, people are motivated by whether there's a ticket for speeding or not, whether there's a, you know, whether there's a somewhere along the line you're going to get caught. And what I'm saying is prosecutors, if they, first of all, they have to have evidence to support a grand jury indictment or an information, but that gets tested in court is what I'm trying to say. Like, so, you know, Barr could do all of this stuff, but ultimately, if there is not the evidence, they will get caught at some point through the judicial process that is not political because it boils down to actual evidence. So if the evidence is literally not there, there's nothing they can't do anything about it.
Okay, because I'm trying to think like Trump thinks.
Okay,
and I know this is a dangerous thing. He's remembering when James Comey came out and at least just said, okay, remember that big press conference where he gave where he said he was not charging, the first one, where he's not charging Hillary Clinton, but he goes through all of the evidence and everything and says all kinds of things. So you know that in Bill Barr's mind, he's capable of just, you know, reading a report and saying, we found serious misconduct. We are not bringing criminal charges. But it's the nothing that is extraordinary to me, because Barr has shown a willingness to lie about the Mueller report, to spin or twist any sort of evidence. The complete silence really is striking to me.
No, I actually, when you frame it that way, I totally agree. Barr is a political sort of sidekick of the president. He's not a neutral officer of the law on behalf of the American people. He's made that very clear. He made that clear before he came into office when he wrote that, you know, long memorandum to the president, basically, you know, auditioning for the job and say, listen, I'll be your Roy Cohn. And then he did it when he basically undermined his old friend and colleague, Robert Mueller, devastatingly by mischaracterizing the careful work of the Mueller investigation in a 4-page memo. So yeah, I don't know. I my mind doesn't think that way, Charlie. I do think one possible explanation is what you suggest, which is that, you know, there's some place within the professional ranks, they're like, enough is enough. We're not doing it. I mean, because their options really are to band together in some capacity or to quit one by one. And this is one thing I haven't really understood why, say, Republicans in Congress haven't just gotten together and said, listen, it's worth saving the party. So let's together just take a different tack when it comes to this would-be dictator. They just haven't. So maybe you're right. Maybe within the Justice Department, as you frame it that way, I actually haven't thought about it. I think that it is pretty stunning, unless Bill Barr is, you know, sick. I don't know. I mean, that's pure speculation.
And you can tell how angry the president is, because he's asked during a Newsmax interview yesterday, are you going to keep Bill Barr around? I mean, Bill Barr, you know, along with Mike Pompeo, has been the most loyal, you know, bodyguard for the president, and he wouldn't commit to it. So he's almost getting the Jeff Sessions treatment here. So I just found that remarkable that happened. And of course, you made reference to the New York Post article, which we're not going to spend a huge amount of time on. Look, I have to say, it's like, you know, that they're throwing this stuff up against the wall. This is, you know, more Hunter Biden, more Burisma stuff. What was striking to me, though, is what a damn squib that story is, but also how it just reeks of bogusness, that essentially you have what I think is going to turn out to be Russian disinformation laundered through the New York Post and much of the credulous conservative media. I think Twitter probably mishandled that by trying to censor it, because now that's the big theme in conservative media. Oh, big media is censoring this bombshell report, which I don't think is going to hold up. But once again, this is where Trump's head's at.
Yeah, my favorite tweet on that was, so everything else aside, dropping off 3 laptops to be repaired and not picking them up is something people do a lot. I mean, it just doesn't pass the straight face test, right?
It's so ludicrous. It is so ludicrous. This reporter who wrote this, I think, has had three bylines. She used to be a Hannity segment producer. She's got pictures of herself on social media with Roger Stone and Steve Bannon. I mean, I the question I have in my mind is, how did this actually even come to publication? And how? But again, one of the things we've seen in the Trump world is that they're prepared just to throw out chaff, to throw out bogus stories, and just figure that you flood the zone with shit. And even when it doesn't pan out, at least you've created that crisis, that chaos for the moment. It feels off topic now.
Well, oh, completely. But I mean, I think they're onto something in that, I actually had a young person come and do a sort of video segment for another show this week. And he comes from Ohio. He's probably in his 20s. And he's, a very conservative family, didn't know anyone of color growing up, even in college, and then came to Washington for work. And he said, my whole perspective changed. And he said, because my family only gets their information from Fox News. I mean, that is it. And so if that is your perception of reputable, coherent news, which is what was the case maybe, in the 80s or 90s when there were only a few sources and they self-policed for accuracy, you can't really blame people. I mean, at this point, people don't know how to separate truth, accuracy from spin, from bogusness. And I think that literally we need, an intro course in every college and high school on how to weed through that stuff, because it's not done for us anymore. And I think the Trump campaign and the Russians exquisitely understand it. It's just this one in this downward spiral that we're watching Donald Trump in, it just looks really pathetic. It looks sad. I mean, and I don't mean in a compassionate way, because it's hard to have a lot of compassion for him at this point.
But it's also dangerous because, you're describing an information ecosystem of chaos, and that'll stay around.
Yeah,
that doesn't go away.
Right. And Putin understands this. I mean, he doesn't have an army to invade the shores of the United States and take over. I mean, he understands the way to kind of control and get a hold of control of the American government and American populace is by splitting it with disinformation. I mean, the framers understood this. This is why we don't have a direct democracy like the Articles of Confederation. We have a republic where we have representatives, because they understood that when populism takes hold with bad information, people make terrible decisions against their self-interest. And now it's on Uber steroids. The Russians understood it. In 2016, of course, they were using Russian bots. In 2020, leading up to this election, it's Americans and the president himself that is planting or that are planting false information. So this is where we've come in 4 years.
That is the extraordinary thing. What do you need Russian disinformation when you have the president of the United States? Really? What is the great vector of disinformation in America? It is the Oval Office.
Right. It's not Putin anymore. Putin's like kicked back with his, margarita. I mean, who needs that when you've got the White House doing it for you?
All right. Well, let's talk about what should have been the consuming story of the week. We've talked about this before. The Republican opportunity to put another conservative on the Supreme Court for another 30 or 40 years. And yet this does feel like kind of a sideshow. We just found out that Lindsey Graham has set the committee vote for 1 week from today, October 22nd. They are obviously determined and set, and it appears to be inevitable that she is going to be confirmed on a strict party line vote. But you've been watching these hearings more than the average person. So give me your sense after 4 days of hearings. What did we learn? What did we not learn?
Yeah, I've been watching it carefully, as a law professor, constitutional scholar. She and I have very similar backgrounds, frankly. I mean, she has 7 kids. I have 4 kids. I was hoping, to see from her, given that it is a shoe-in, right? It's a shoe-in because we don't have a filibuster anymore, just so listeners understand that. Prior to Gorsuch, you had to have buy-in from the minority party, which looped in the minority Americans who don't have someone in the White House, right? But now it's a purely party-line vote. So anyone who's not in the Republican Party just is basically cut out of this absolutely critical decision. Or as I said, even if someone's not a Trump supporter, people on for life that will change our lives forever. And that's a system, that's an issue for the Supreme, for basically Congress to fix, the Senate to fix. But well, you know, she, it really disappointed me, Charlie, that she didn't take this opportunity to say, you know what, I know that there's a fix and I'm going to be on, but I just want to answer these questions in a way that gives some comfort level to the people that were disenfranchised in this process with the last three justices, that I am going to be reasonable. She wouldn't answer things like, you know, Amy Klobuchar said, is it a bad thing or against the law to intimidate voters at the polls? And she refused to answer that. And then Amy Klobuchar cites her a federal statute. I mean, this is a law professor. She wouldn't say whether, you know, voting by mail during a pandemic is helpful for voters or something along those lines. She wouldn't say really clearly whether a president would be in his rights to refuse to transfer power on, you know, after an election, suggesting that there might be a legal question about using force to stay in office.
This is what puzzles me. I mean, I get the fact that these have become kabuki dances going back a long way, that they don't answer questions. And I understand that she's been coached not to take a position on any issue, but some of those questions were rather remarkably easy. They're just civics 101.
Yes.
You know, obviously the easy answer is, a voter intimidation is against the law. I am a judge who would uphold the law, and I would certainly uphold the. I mean, what? That's an easy one. Or, of course, the Constitution provides for the peaceful transfer of power. I mean, I'm an originalist, right? The founding fathers exactly. thought the peaceful transfer of power was important. There's no question about that. These are easy questions.
Right. And just, I mean, but she was willing to say that, you know, Establishment Clause, that is the First Amendment law, is, you know, in disorder, needs to be reorganized, which to me is a pretty major statement suggesting, because we're seeing, Charlie, a push to basically merge, you know, Christianity and the federal government. I mean, to de-separate church and state. So to me, that was a nod to maybe the Federalists or her or that base saying, you know, don't worry, I got that covered. I have my eye on that. She sort of almost jumped affirmatively to answer that question, which I would say under her judicial canon, this notion I can't say anything about anything, would be something she'd refuse to answer. But she was fine on certain topics. She talked about Second Amendment and the space in after Heller to change gun laws. Like, she was able to do that. I just want to, just a little anecdote. When she said she can't answer hypotheticals, I actually gave two law school exams yesterday to, you know, about 180 law students. And one of my law students sent me an email with that attached a couple of memes that are going around on TikTok in the law student community saying, Professor Whaley, we can't answer hypotheticals because we're learning to be lawyers, so we're not going to take your exam.
That's pretty good. That's good.
Yeah. They saw right through it, right?
Well, I also thought it was interesting when they walked her through some of the precedents and the they said, well, Brown versus Board of Education is a precedent you'd uphold. Yes, no problem. You know, the Loving case about miscegenation. Yes, absolutely no problem. Then they get to Griswold and it's like, well, no, I can't be talking about it. So she's willing to endorse certain precedents. They seem to be involving race, but anything outside of that, she became very coy.
She wouldn't
Did
talk
you notice
about
that line? She was willing to endorse some cases, but then drew the line.
Shelby County versus Holder. I mean, this is Amy Klobuchar's issue. I mean, one of the huge questions looming.
That's voting rights.
Moment, right. And that's the one striking down a critical part of the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
I mean, this is you know, back to my book. Historically, Congress has tried really hard to fix a number of things with our electoral process. Campaign finance reform, the Voting Rights Act, gerrymandering, or actually they didn't do gerrymandering, the Supreme Court stuck in there. But my point is, those are two big pieces. And the Supreme Court comes back and strikes them down. So the question is, okay, in this moment, if the legislature can't fix voting because the Supreme Court's going to come in, how are we going to go back to government by we the people? And she refused to even talk about the Voting Rights Act. This is an act of Congress. I mean, in terms of, you know, the tricky part about it of protecting individual voting rights. And I just thought, to your point, I just thought it was really cynical and very, very sad that she didn't take this moment. She's obviously very smart. She knows her stuff, but she didn't take this moment to sort of take the high road and say, I'm going to be a justice for all Americans. There's no reason she couldn't answer certain questions and then answer others. And then all along, she has this sort of point that, oh, I'm a good judge because I only apply the rule of law. It's like, Every judge judges, and originalists judge too, and she sort of admitted that. But my concern is that people think, oh, she's a really good judge because she's not an activist judge. Well, I'll tell you, taking healthcare away from 20 million people, potentially, that's pretty much judicial activism when you're upsetting an act of Congress that represents the will of the people, and these judges are not elected. I think one conservative principle really should be judicial restraint. And I didn't hear that from her.
She did suggest that there was a way to uphold uphold Obamacare. She talked about severability,
right,
and seemed to be implying, at least to my layman's ears, seemed to be implying that she was open to the idea that, yes, you can take out the individual mandate without invalidating the whole law, which is the whole point of this case before the U.S. Supreme Court. Correctly. I mean, she used the game Jenga sort of as an example of that. So.
Yeah, she
during a hearing in which she was not willing to answer very many questions, she did seem to be rather that seemed to be very specific to me, and that's seemed true. To be really to signal how she might come down on that particular case.
Well, just so people know, two things with that case. One is what happened in the Sebelius case is the court held that the individual mandate was a tax under the Constitution.
Right.
She wrote Roberts was off, you know, had stretched the plain language of the statute beyond its, you know, reasonable interpretation. So she was critical of that. Then Congress got cynical and basically zeroed out the penalty. And so said in the big tax cut legislation in 2017. So then it's like, oh, it's not a tax anymore, because guess what? We're not raising any revenue because we lowered the penalty to nothing. So there are actually two issues before the court. Mm-hmm. One is whether now that it's zero, that is legitimately it's unconstitutional, or where you can still call it a tax. So there still is a way to basically uphold the entire law, but she seems to have skipped over that and assumed that's lower courts found for, you know, striking down the ACA. She seems to skip over that. And then the question becomes, okay, do we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater? And that's the issue of severability. And I think you're right. Pressed, she did seem to suggest that she's open to that. And so, you know, I guess there's a nod in her corner in that regard. But overall, I thought I would have liked to see more candor. I mean, I kept, you know, imagining if I were ever, of course, would never happen in that hypothetical seat, how I could do it as answer those questions in a way that shows some compassion and empathy. Because, Charlie, this isn't just, you know, legal, you know, sort of ahead of a pin type analysis. I mean, people are literally afraid. LGBT community has anxiety about their future. People are worried about the election. People are worried about their healthcare. People are worried about women are worried about being able to safely make decisions about whether to have a family or whether their health will be in jeopardy if they have to take it into their own hands. I mean, that she answered in such a technical, lawyerly, politician way. I just thought it was disappointing.
Where do you come down on the question of court packing, which, you know, seems to have disappeared from the news cycle, at least temporarily? I remember over the weekend, my personal theory was the Twitterverse was bored and they had to have something to talk about. So it was like, you know, when is Joe Biden going to answer this question? He appears to have answered the question that he's not a fan of court packing, which is consistent with his position. But if, in fact, there is a Democratic majority next year, should they go ahead and at least consider it or not? Because it in the past, it's been kind of a political shoal, you know, most famously FDR,
right,
at the height of his political power, failed to expand the number of Supreme Court justices. And that historical precedent hangs over everybody's head. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I actually do think it's a fair issue to put on the table, and I'll explain why. I mean, first of all, the Constitution doesn't say how many justices are on the Supreme Court, and it's varied. I mean, there were six or nine now. That is set by Congress. So ultimately, this would be a decision for Congress, not for Joe Biden individually or unilaterally. Court packing, like lots of things, has negative connotations. It essentially means amending the statute to enlarge the size of the Supreme Court. And I think the reason that it's now on the table is because of how Mitch McConnell has, in a way, packed the Supreme Court now with a conservative majority that doesn't reflect, you know, the American populace, and did it in a way that sort of trashed the legitimacy of the system. And I really worry a lot about the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. I mean, Barack Obama, an originalist, someone like Coney Barrett would read Article 2, shall appoint, shall. It's not ambiguous. That was Obama's prerogative to do that. There's only four Democratic nominees since 1969 appointments and 15 conservatives. And certainly it hasn't been a conservative sort of dominance of, you know, the entire political spectrum all of those years. So, and then of course, you know, there's questions as to why Kennedy handed over his seat when he did to a protege, Brett Kavanaugh. And of course that was a nightmare, that scenario, how he was appointed, that process of confirmation. And then we've got, as you indicate, you know, tens of millions of votes already and days before an election and, you know, she's going to be confirmed. So I think it's been set up in a way that it feels so unfair. It feels like so many people are cut out of that system and cut out of the court. And, you know, Charlie, five people can amend the Constitution on the United States Supreme Court by interpreting it one way. It takes two-thirds of both houses of Congress and three-quarters ratification of the states for the people to do it. They have too much power. They just have too much power, period. That's my view.
I think we've discovered this. This should not be as consuming as it in fact has become. Look, I'm on record as thinking this is a bad idea to pack the court, but I would also say this. That the new political norm seems to be, if you can do it, we will do it. You know, I win, you lose. Why do the Republicans push through this nomination during an election after promising not to? Because they can. So if that is the new norm of American politics, that if you can do something, you should do something, then when the Democrats get in charge and they will point out, hey, this is not unconstitutional. We have the power to do this. We have the votes to do it. If we have the votes to do it, we should do it. And after trashing constitutional norms for years, the Republicans are, of course, going to be indignant about it. But these are the new rules. These are the new norms.
Yeah, the new norms are going to be, we will have empty seats, vacancies on the Supreme Court, unless we have a Senate and a White House that are from the same party. That's basically where we are. That's not good either. So I mean, the Constitution's not crystal clear on a lot of stuff. Really crystal clear that this is up to the president to do this, and that the House, you know, the Senate Majority Leader doesn't get to just not allow it to go forward. But you know what, Charlie, I think, and I had our friend Amanda Carpenter on IGTV with me yesterday, and talking about how, and I think this was in your newsletter also, just how there's kind of moderates from, you know, the blue and the red sides of 10 years ago are now coming together and talking about just being, you know, common sense and some sense of value and integrity. And that's what's lost. That's why we're in such this huge mess. And I know you also quoted Eisenhower in your newsletter today. And I love his quote that he said, "The supreme quality for leadership is unquestionably integrity. Without it, no real success is possible, no matter whether it is on a section gang, a football field, in an army, or in an office." I mean, this is common sense. This is how the human species gets along. And we're missing it right now. And that's why things in my mind are so messed up.
So that quote from Eisenhower, I didn't quote Eisenhower. That was James Carville. No, I mean, let's think about this for a moment, because it really underlines your point. James Carville, the raging Cajun, has written a piece for The Bulwark. Okay, I want everyone to think about this. And actually, he's got a line in here. Let me see if I can actually find it, because he talks about the noble. It's really an outstanding speech. And he says, look, long after Trump is gone, this unity forged in his opposition should be remembered. My participation on this site, The Bulwark, which is operated by many of my former Republican rivals, is evidence of this unity in and of itself. This article posted right here is evidence that this is a moment that carries extraordinary consequences, much more profound than victory or defeat for a candidate. And I have to tell you that if somebody would have told me a few years ago that we would be publishing an article by James Carville, or that James Carville and I would be on the same subject, I would have thought you were absolutely insane. Okay, I have one more question about court packing. Because I'm slightly obsessed with the historical precedent and what happened here. The real significance of Roosevelt's effort to pack the court was not just in the fact that he suffered a political defeat. He actually scored a legal victory, because the court had been ruling against one New Deal program after another. He tries to pack the court. He fails, but the court got the message. And as a result, the court became much less confrontational. So I guess the question I'm asking is, as the justices gather, they can do lots of things with their 6-3 conservative majority. But I wonder whether or not this is going to be in their minds that the legitimacy and the future of the court is very much in play, and might encourage them not to. I mean, the court always has a chance to rule narrowly or to be go big and bold. And I'm wondering whether or not this might influence them somewhat. We're not supposed to think that politics influences the court, but we all know that it in fact does.
Yeah, and Roberts cares a lot about the legitimacy of the court, and now he's no longer the swing vote with Barrett on, or soon to be on. But I love that story, and actually do tell my students about that, because, you know, the way that happened, essentially, you know, we had the Great Depression and we had an unregulated economy, and basically, you know, the agencies that dot Washington, D.C., if you drive around, those were all produced basically or largely around in Roosevelt's New Deal. And people were worried that he was amassing too much power in the White House. I mean, it's ironic to see how history, you know, repeats itself, because we're worried about that right now too, right? And so the court came in and revived old doctrines like dormant commerce clause and non-delegation, things that are never used, to start striking down the New Deal programs. And that's, as you say, then Roosevelt said, okay, you're going to do this to me, I'm going to then add enough justices that you can't kill my regulatory legislative process to basically get the country back on its feet. And the court backed off. It's unbelievable. And since then, you know, litigants have tried to revive those doctrines that the court used for a very short period of time to strike down the New Deal stuff, haven't been able to do it. So to your point, I think it's going to be really interesting as a legal scholar, how the law evolves in reaction to the political system. I hope, honestly, I know Brett Kavanaugh personally. I have a tremendous amount of respect for his legal acumen, frankly. You know, I think these are reasonable people. I thought Sheldon Whitehouse's speech about sort of the dark money influence in the courts, that was a bit chilling. I hope the justices are watching this, and they're one of the few places in American governmental system where there still is this sense of respect and decorum, and you know, not backstabbing, at least amongst the nine of them. And you know, maybe, I don't know, maybe we could forge a third party of humanity, you know, humility, values, integrity, and common sense. I don't know, to follow up on that kind of a sort of a spirit in the federal judiciary.
We need to leave on that note of optimism, because we have so few notes of optimism like that. You know, let's at least, you know, think about that for a few minutes. So, Kim Whaley, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We always appreciate it.
Thank you, Charlie. It's always great on my end, too.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. There are 19 days to go until Election Day.